Accession number 30078, reel 9.
What was the reason for that?
I have no idea. Maybe it could have been the thought that the Koreans hadn't got much from what they had they should retain. I honestly don't know. It was a typical English approach, I think, of non-fraternization. But I got very friendly with Captain Song, the Korean captain, and actually he took me out to Seoul two or three times, which was interesting because I saw Seoul a little bit from the Korean side, took me to a family he knew and showed me around the sights and so on, although, as I say, much of it was ruined. And so I probably saw more than most people. But otherwise there was no contact. The only thing that you did know about them was that as you approached a village, there was this strong, overpowering curry smell of kimchi. That was their great big thing, and you could smell it. As you came towards the village, you'd say, "Oh, kimchi, we're near somewhere."
Did you ever try it?
Yes, I don't like it.
Did you have any impression as to how the Koreans felt about the United Nations action and the occupations that there from the various nationalities?
I haven't really, although I know Captain Song did mention to me once or twice that they were very pleased that United Nations had come in because the North Koreans had been pretty drastic, rather like the modern Taliban are acting over in Afghanistan. This may be the nurse. So,
did you feel that you were part of the, just fighting as part of the Cold War, or did it feel like a more specific action for the sake of?
Well, I think it felt specific because you were orientated onto the thing you were doing, which for us was the Korean War, whereas the Cold War covered the globe, really. I think one read about the Cold War, but as though it was something over there type of thing. But I found that even when I was in England and when I came back, I mean, the Cold War was something that's happening, but not sure what it is or where it is. But Korea, you were specific. I mean, you were on the spot. You knew what was happening. And they were the communists and you were the allies and so on. And we never met except at Panmunjom, where I think I got it right, or I'm not sure if Panmunjom's the capital of North Korea or whether that's the name of the meeting point we had. I think it's the name of the capital, isn't it? But anyhow, there was the DMT, which was the DMZ, which was the demilitarized zone. And that was, I'll do it on the recording if you like, for this bit, if you like. Is it on? There was a DMZ, or Z, which was the demilitarized zone, and that consisted really of an enormous thick barbed wire fence pretty well right across Korea. And that was between the two, and both sides were meant to be at least about a mile and a half back from it. So there was, if you like, an empty space. Now, where we were, the Imjin River formed part of the break between us. I mean, obviously there's no barbed wire on that, but when the line came ashore, and it was roughly on the 38th parallel, there were great big rocks had been painted with 38th parallel. You were not meant to go near the barbed wire, but on a couple of occasions I did go down, again with Norman Phillips in his jeep. We drove down to it, and Chinese patrol came out one time and just came and stared at us. I was trying to think of the few Chinese words I'd learnt to say, "Get your hair cut," but I couldn't think of them. That's all I saw of them. But we could see them on their hills on the other side. If your eyesight was very good, you could just make out the little figures over on the far side, and they probably could see us the same way. But you had no further contact, except for this one point where there was a meeting every week, and you had the American people, the British, or representing the Commonwealth. As I say, it was just for an exchange of information, because apparently part of the Cold War treaty, or whatever one would call it, was that no arms were to be brought in. Well, what you had to prove, or I had to produce figures, was for what had been brought in, other stuff had been got rid of. Whether the Chinese ones were true, whether our ones were true, I don't honestly know, because it was a lot of guesswork in it indeed, and whether the American ones were true, I don't know. But it was all very official. You had a big hut with a table across the centre of it. The North Koreans and Chinese came in from that side. We entered from this side, all at a given signal. You went straight in and you sat down. There were no salutations or greetings, with your senior man in the middle. And then one of the senior men, I don't know how they chose which one, would start the thing and say, well, my report is, and he would read all the report. You sat there, I sat there, for instance, with the papers, and I handed him the papers. I played no other part than that. And at each corner of the room, there were Chinese and North Korean military policemen there, there, and American there and there behind us. And outside, it was masses of military police all staring at the other ones like that, looking as vicious as they could. But that was the only meeting between the two sides. Otherwise, one never saw a Chinese, except, as I say, as a tiny figure in the distance. Next question.
Did you have any sense of what the South Korean attitude was towards the North Koreans as opposed to the Chinese?
Well, really anger, in a way, in that they'd been trampled on as the North Koreans came over. And I mean, they equated, I think, the North Koreans and the Chinese together for having just trampled over them. But I'm sure that they must look upon the Chinese as something different, but how or why, I couldn't really tell you. I mean, China was the older civilization, but I know the Koreans used to like to say that they were the older civilization. They do go back a long way in their history, and they've got their own alphabet as well, which is not characters like Chinese and Japanese. But I couldn't honestly say what their inner heart feeling was about the Chinese.
Did you try learning Korean? Did you try learning Korean?
No. You learned a few words, naturally. But as I say, I had Captain Song pretty well with me the whole time, because he was attached to my office. Why they attached him to Q side, I don't know. But he spoke very good English. He'd been to one of the Korean universities, and I think I just sort of chatted with him, and if anything came up, it was done through him immediately. We didn't really come across them much. They did a certain amount of work in the division, like cleaning the mess, and I'm not sure whether they served a table or not in the mess. But I know they did odd bits, and we had a few Koreans in. The only other way one came across them was what were known as slicky boys. They would creep in at night, slit the side of a tent, and steal what they could. The only people, and this is a true story, the only people who didn't have the attention of the slicky boys was the Turkish brigade, because one morning two dead slicky boys were found on the barbed wire, shot. And the Turks said, well, we thought they were enemy trying to come in. And the word went round, and the Turks were never troubled again, but we had a lot of it. And they were all known as slicky boys. In fact, when we were closing down part of the division, we had to destroy the latrines, and the easiest way to do it was to drop a couple of lumps of gunpowder down them, because there are only holes in the ground, take away the hut at the top and the seat, drop a couple of gunpowder lumps down and let it blow up, and the whole thing would cave in. But when we did one of the divisional ones, the spout that came up included pens, watches, all sorts of things had either been stolen, then quickly dumped, and so on. It was quite an eyesight to see them. But otherwise, no, we didn't have any contact, nor did I know the language.
And when you moved on to Japan again, how had it changed in the years since you'd been there previously?
Tremendously. It was only or when I finally left it, well, roughly 10 years, I suppose, it was quite an eye-opener, the amount of building that had gone on. Nothing like, of course, what it is now. I mean, I see pictures of Tokyo now, I don't recognize the place. It looks like New York or center of London. But having known it all battered and shot down, I was surprised at how much had been done. But remember, I didn't see very much of Japan this time. When you were in Korea, there was R&R leave, 10 days leave. I forget how often, I think once every 6 months or something. Officially called rest and recuperation, but so much drinking and womanizing was done in Japan that most people came back absolutely shattered and needed to recover in their own unit. And in fact, at the airport, I think it was Haneda Airport, there were one or two Japanese who would contact you knowing you were a leave group and would make all the arrangements for you. They'd get you into a hotel, supply a woman, supply the drink, tell you where to go and everything. But I meandered off more. I wanted to see things for myself and see the parts of Japan I'd known before. So I went back to Okayama and I went north up to Hokkaido. I did my womanizing and drinking, but I saw the country as well. So really I had a good overview of the whole country. Except for the southern island, I've only been to one place on it, that's all.
Was the attitude towards the Japanese attitude towards the UN soldiers any?
No, I didn't really notice it. You felt quite at home there. Whether they felt at home with you, I don't know. But remember, they had American and other soldiers there from the end of the war. And although there wasn't the presence there had been originally, there was a presence in Tokyo. But so few that you hardly ever saw them around. And I think, obviously, by then, many people were allowed to wear mufti, who were actually stationed in Japan, so you wouldn't know who they were, tourists or what. But I felt nothing at all odd about it. I felt quite at home, in fact.
Did your Chinese help?
No, I was a failure on that course, and like any language you learn, try and learn quickly, it fades quickly if you don't use it. This was brought home to me very clearly at the beginning of the World War II, when you remember I was adjutant of the Regimental Training Center, and the officers who had recently been retired and that, or who had been on the reserve for two or three or longer years, were called back from England. The first week, their Urdu was very halting. The second week, you could see them getting it more. By the end of a month, it was back just like that. Whereas if you learn a language quickly, it goes quickly. I mean, I can still speak Urdu, and I talk to two of the shopkeepers here, and there's no problem with it. But Chinese, apart from bu hao, meaning bad, and how meaning good, I don't think I can remember anything else. And again, you've so much got to get the tone right. There was one word, I forget, I think you, and depending on how you pronounce the four tones, I think it could either mean rain or fish, and two other meanings, I can't remember what they were. So you could easily say, oh look, it's fishing from the cloud, or I'm going to catch a rain or something. That's what I found so difficult, was the tonal side of it. And I'm very good at giving in, so I gave in and got posted.
But did you try learning Japanese? Did you try learning Japanese while you were there?
Oh yes. I spoke quite reasonable Japanese, and in fact so much so that when Chiyo came over here, which was 1958, because it was a year after I married, I left her for a year and said I have to find out where I'm going to live and what I'm going to do. I had spoken to her all the time in Japanese, and it wasn't until she came here we realized if this went on, her English would never improve. And funnily enough, she joined Air France, as you may know, and she said 32 years with them in Heathrow and did very, very well. efficiently. I mean, they couldn't promote her because she couldn't speak conversational French. But now she's come home and is retired, and I don't know if you saw it, she has a Japanese TV, it's off satellite. Her English is going. She's hearing Japanese the whole time, and I'm fairly a loner. I stay upstairs a lot and do my own thing. And her English has got noticeably much worse. And of course, my Japanese, when I came back, as I said, we're going to talk English only, so you'll learn it. My Japanese started to go fairly quickly. I could make my way now in Japan if I wanted to, but it would only be, where is the station? What time does the train go? Where is the hotel? Can I have a room? That sort of thing. But if somebody started a conversation, no, I wouldn't be able to do it.
When you returned from the Australian Army, did you again have any employment ambitions?
It was difficult. My mother was still alive. That's why I told you why I came back. She actually died a year later, but she had not been well. I looked around for work. I was a bit horrified because the sort of answer I got in many cases was, well, look, you're just over 40 now, and therefore you won't fit into our pension scheme. So I'm sorry, you can't have it. And I hadn't a clue what to do. I tried various interviews, and I'm sorry, you're over 40, or no, you haven't got experience of that. And I couldn't offer any experience other than army, and just ordinary army. That I hadn't even been a specialist. Finally, again in the paper, I saw an advertisement which said, do you love your fellow man? You know, this, this and the other. Apply the London Probation Service. So I thought, well, I may not love my fellow man, but I have worked with my fellow man all my life. So I applied, and what had happened was that normally they took people in from universities, but there'd been a big expansion, and they wanted people, so they decided to get older people in who dealt with other humans during their life, and they accepted me as from the army. We did a short training course, and then I was in the London Probation Service, where I stayed for 22 years. I was not a good probation officer because I could never get out of my head the fact that one knows when one is doing wrong. I mean, if I was going to do something wrong, I knew it was wrong, but I did it because I wanted to. The probation people coming from university were all psychology and that sort of thing, and they go off in long, long reasoning and this, that and the other. When I used to say simply, well, the man's a crook and he's just decided to do it, that's all. Oh, no, no, it couldn't be. It must be deeper reasons. His mother didn't love him or something. So the result was, which was good for me in the end, they wouldn't let me deal with juveniles because I was too disciplinarian, apparently. And with the ordinary probation people, they knew that my heart wasn't really in it. So they put me onto the people with no home. You know, sleep rough. Oh, I can't think of the word. Anyhow, I dealt with those people because a lot of them were getting into trouble almost inadvertently. I mean, the only way, for instance, a man sleeping on the pavement could forget his troubles often was drinking, and police usually didn't worry them. But occasionally you got a zealous policeman who would arrest them, they'd be brought to court. That was my job to deal with them. I would find maybe a Salvation Army hostel, but I knew they'd only stay there a day or two. Many of them, amazingly, were happy where they were in the cardboard boxes. Two of them stick in my mind. This has nothing to do with the army now. Two of them stick in my mind. They held both ex-regimental sergeant majors. And in both cases, they'd had 40-something years in the army. And the coming out and having to feed themselves, clothe themselves, responsibility, and that, they just couldn't face it. And they started to drink a little, and then a bit more and a bit more. They were very heavy drinkers, both of them. They weren't together, they were separate. But one thing was noticeable with both of them, that however ragged they were always tidy. The tie was properly tied, if they wore a tie, or coat was buttoned up. They were always neat and tidy. The army training was innately in them. But they couldn't handle civilian life. They'd been looked after for 40 years, fed and clothed and everything. It was just too much. They were both actually very nice people indeed. I liked them both. It was rather funny, under the arches at Charing Cross Station, they all used to sleep on either side. There are shops there now. And if I wanted to embarrass somebody or impress somebody, I'd say, oh, come for a walk. Let's go and go past the people who are sleeping on the thing. And every so far, a voice would look up and say, hello, Patrick. And the person with me would say, oh, how do they know you? What's that? And I say, oh, that's one of my cousins. Leave it at that. But I was very sorry for them as well. And I found I had empathy there. And that when they got into trouble, it was very, very seldom it was what you might say with criminal intent. It was either through being drunk because they were fed up with life or some small thing like that. I had 22 years of that. And then had a whacking great operation on my back, the first one, which put me out for almost a whole year, which was sick leave. They gave it to me too, and then retired. Since retirement, I've run the Indian Army Association until this year, 38 years of it, and this year closed it down.
Was it relatively common for long-serving members of the Army to then find that when they left, it was difficult?
If they had a lot of service, yes. And when you've had like these two over 40 years, since you were yourself 18 or 19, you know, everything's been done. You've been clothed and fed and that, and it's a sudden shock to come out and have to do it for yourself. There was another class of person, too, who you tended to meet up a lot with, and that was the middle-aged and slightly older man. There'd been a divorce in the family. He'd been ordered to pay his wife a set amount of money, and they found it difficult to live themselves and pay that amount of money. They knew that if they didn't pay it, they could be taken to prison. And so they gave up, and they just went rough. That means they didn't have to support themselves, the charity. They either could say they couldn't pay the ex-wife because they were on benefit, or with what benefit they would send the money regularly. There were quite a lot of them who I was rather sorry for, because there'd been no crime or anything. It was just a personality split. But there wasn't enough money to keep going. And they were usually the older person who found it difficult to get a job anyhow. There were some younger people on the streets who, again, I felt sorry for, in that life at home was so bloody that they felt they just couldn't take any more of it when they got to the middle of the teens, and they just took off. Those you could help via some of the hostels. Salvation Army especially, the Catholic one called The Corridor near Westminster Cathedral. I knew a number of those places. I could often get a person in there, and then they would sort of try and help him. But I dealt with the, what I was trying to think of, no fixed abode, they called, NFA. So I had that side only. Because, as I say, I couldn't deal with juveniles, I was too militaristic. The other ones, I felt you're a crook, really, but you know, I'm not going to make up psychological reasoning. So, like in the Army, I never saw any fighting, so in civilian life it wasn't a very great success.
Was there sufficient state support for the... was there state support for the no fixed abode people as much as it could have been?
I don't know what it was, but it was very low. That's all they had, and it was very difficult to live on. They really had, in some cases, I know, to rely on the, well, for instance, the Salvation Army nightly soup run, which came down Charing Cross every night. Some really had to rely on that for a recent good meal. And then things like, I don't know if you've heard of Crisis at Christmas. Well, I did that for 10 years, you know, there were many others. And the people who came there, we used to take in, I think, about 600 people, just sleeping absolutely one by one on the floor. And food was a great attraction, a decent meal, which we could lay on by virtue of the generosity of many companies, especially Marks and Spencers, who the day before Boxing Day, day before Christmas and again Boxing Day, van after van after van of Marks and Spencer would come from all their branches around London with food that would outdate and things like that. And I would see so many of the men I knew, in fact I used to tell lots of them, well, this year crisis is going to be at so-and-so, come up there. And so what struck me there, and it's never mentioned, there's always so much in the papers about young people being bolshy and difficult, quite a lot of young people used to come up for the whole week of crisis. They would sleep on the floor in a separate room. They maybe go home just one day only. They spend the whole of their Christmas week up there looking after these people, feeding them, helping them, doing all sorts of things. And you never saw that reported at all. I was very impressed with them. And I used to get an overall view of it because I used to appoint myself quartermaster and deal with all the stores that came in and giving the stores going out. It meant I had something to keep me really doing stuff. And so I could see it from an overall view, and these youngsters were good. Never once have I seen it mentioned in the papers or anything that X number of students and others gave up their Christmas. So there is a good side to people.
In the case of those from the Army in particular, did the Army as an institution, think it had a responsibility that it perhaps wasn't addressing? A responsibility towards those who'd left the service that it wasn't addressing?
I never came across it. I mean, they do things. For instance, have you heard of combat stress? Well, I mean, they look after people who are a bit damaged mentally and otherwise by war. There is, I believe, an Army Welfare Association, but actually I never came into contact with it. When I talk about many of them are ex-army, this is many in a vast crowd of people, because the number of people who sleep out in London is quite great. You only see one or two here and there, and they get moved on quite often, but overall it's quite a big number. And I don't know now, because after all I've been retired now for nearly 30 years, and but one reads of the increase in youngsters sleeping out. I wouldn't like to, although they tell me that cardboard is very warming and a cardboard box is not that bad. I had enough of it in the Army, just sleeping rough. I'm not that keen on it. So there we are, a very uneventful life.